Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution. It sounds like a whisper. Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution. It sounds like a whisper. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines.
It's Dr. K back here on the Mark Steiner Show. You are listening to Talking About a Revolution by Tracy Chapman. On December 6, 1865, the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, officially ending the institution of slavery, was ratified. It says neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for crime, whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdictions. With these words, the single greatest change brought about from the Civil War was officially noted in the Constitution. Now, this ratification came 8 months after the end of the war, but it represented the culmination of a long struggle against slavery. To talk to us about these changes and about how far we need to go, joining us today is Dr. Joycelyn Moody. And she is the Sue E. Denman Distinguished Chair in American Literature at the University of Texas at San Antonio, where she teaches and researches 19th century African-American literature. Good morning. How are you, Dr. Moody?
I'm fine, thanks. It's good to be here.
Thank you. And we also have Dr. Treva Lindsay. She's an assistant professor of women's, gender, and sexuality studies at The Ohio State University. Good morning, Dr. Lindsay.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. I also wanted to ask you, Dr. Lindsay, if I'm not mistaken, you also have a role within the Black Lives Matter movement in Ohio?
Yes. I was the coordinator for the Columbus to Ferguson effective resistance movement, and also am still involved with the OSU Black Lives Matter chapter.
So we're going to talk a lot about that kind of in the second part of our conversation. In this first part, we want to talk and kind of help situate the 13th Amendment. And Dr. Lindsay, I want to start a bit with you. Can you set the stage for us and tell us a bit about what was happening in the country prior to December 6th? I mean, the war had ended on April 9th, and the Emancipation Proclamation had already been out 2 years prior to this.
Right. And so with the end of this, we have this incredible moment here where we really have to think about how the state is going to respond to what essentially is going to be a huge transformation in terms of what the landscape of the United States looks like. You have, of course, the South, which seceded from the Union. You have a lot of people still wondering, what does this look like post-slavery, post the antebellum period. It is before the moment which we come to know as Reconstruction. And so this is really the very beginning of what we consider the post-emancipation moment, the emancipation moment, in fact. And so you have a considerable amount of still uncertainty that's coming into bear. And you still have a lot of pushback in terms of what it's going to mean in terms of authoring an amendment that's really going to ensure that slavery does not continue. How do we create a context in which this thing is finally abolished, even in addition to the Emancipation Proclamation, which in fact says something about how tightly our nation was still holding on to the vestiges of what is chattel slavery up until this point. And so I think it's really important to note that this two-year period in between is a period in which we see the end of the war, yes, but we still have some questions about what this is going to mean in terms of the future of the nation, in the terms of amnesty, in the terms of Reconstruction. This is setting the stage for that moment.
And so, Dr. Moody, to pick up on that, Reconstruction began immediately and lasted until about 1877. And some consider this to be a major push moment in civil rights. But others, like historian Eric Foner, said it was a failure because free people were forced into second-class citizenship with limited rights. They were excluded from the political process. Can you talk a bit about how Reconstruction was situated from your perspective?
Sure. I'm thinking especially this morning about two women who kind of, two women writers who can tell us a lot in their autobiographies and their novels about what Reconstruction was like, in particular for Black women. I'm coming off teaching a course on Black feminism, so I've had a lot of these ideas running around in my head with undergraduate students talking about them. Two women that I'm thinking about this morning are Mattie J. Jackson, who wrote a story of her life with her grand aunt, L.S. Schuyler. This was published, this was set in St. Louis in 1866. So it has a very unique setting as an autobiography written about slavery using all the characteristics of a novel, of an autobiography designed to end slavery coming out just after the 13th Amendment. This is a story of tremendous heroism. It tells some very unusual things about slavery. For example, Mattie J. Jackson and her mother at one point taking the whip, the literal instrument of torture, a whip that their master had used on them, and forming it in the shape of a W, which was his last name, Williams, and getting revenge on him, breaking it, in other words. And it even has an incident in it where they arrange for their master to be punished by the Union Army. This is set in St. Louis at the site of the Grand Army headquarters, actually on the site of St. Louis University where I used to teach. Another figure, so that tells us a lot about how Black women used the army during the last years of the war, the very last year of the war, as a matter of fact, in order to begin to exercise their civil rights and to transition into lives of heroism and resistance and a kind of Black female power, if you will. And then the other figure I'm thinking about is Julia Collins, who was not born into slavery, who lived in the Pennsylvania Valley and wrote in the last year of the war some of the most important essays for Black women that would determine the shape of their lives during Reconstruction. Everything she wrote in her essays about Black life and what women should be doing as they seized citizenship. That was very important to the readers of the Christian Recorder, where her essays were published. Her serialized novel, The Curse of Caste, was about a tragic mulatto figure, as the phrase goes, who also began to come to terms with what it meant to exercise female power.
Okay, Dr. Lindsay, I think there are people that are really not familiar with Reconstruction. I'm surprised when I talk to young people about it. And they know the time period, kind of, but they don't really know everything that happened during that period. So I wanted to just throw out a couple of things and ask you just to fill in the gaps and maybe tell us some of the lessons that we can learn as we begin to kind of push towards talking about where we are today. So we know that during this period, we had the passage of the 14th and the 15th Amendment for citizenship and the right to vote. We had the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1875, which made it illegal to segregate schools, right? Places of public accommodation and modes of transportation. But by 1896, which is outside of Reconstruction, but you had Plessy v. Ferguson, which is separate but equal. And that kind of began that 58-year period of Jim Crow. So even though this was a high moment and a low moment for the Black community, are there some lessons that we can learn from that?
Yes. So it's really how people talk about what Reconstruction optimism among African Americans turns to Jim Crow realism very quickly, that shift that happens. Whereas you see, actually, during this very brief period, if you think about this in the context of just a little over a decade, you see the development of historically Black colleges and universities that come into fruition during this period. You have actually a number of African-American men who end up in Congress as a result of this, with voting power. You, of course, have the voting rights that are given to Black men, which are quickly, of course, taken away. You have a number of services, because part of this is restoring the South, the kind of actual devastation of the material devastation of the South that happens during this period as well. And we're recovering from such an incredibly violent war. With a number of people and families that are destroyed as well. And you have that instant resentment that's happening between the communities, between Black people and white people, poor white people in the South, middle class and upper class white people all over, thinking about what this will mean to compete for this limited number of positions that are now available, but still also having this agrarian economy that's going to suddenly spike into this more industrialized, mass commodification kind of economy that's going to happen later in the 19th century and certainly throughout the 20th century. And so in response to this moment of these perceived gains, there has to be these pushbacks, and they come from the states' rights-oriented discourse. Of course, you have the formation of the Ku Klux Klan and other kinds of racial, anti-black racial terrorist groups to respond to this, the enactment of black codes that culminates, of course, with Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896, which is really a retrenchment and reversal of these rights. So thinking about this in terms of 2015 really means with these great kind of progressive moments that we see in terms of racial progress, the backlash is often sudden, swift, and sweeping that we see. And how we prepare for knowing that the responses to the kind of tearing down or dismantling of even little parts of white supremacist states or white supremacist laws, institutions, will be met with this, because at the very foundation of our nation is slavery, is the genocide of indigenous people, is the disenfranchisement of women. That is built into the very fabric of how we think about our democracy in this nation. We have to be amended into justice consideration, right? That's something to consider. And so when these amendments happen, obviously this amending, this change, is something that is responded to, because although the law changes, people don't change quite as quickly. Thoughts, perceptions, and longstanding racial and racist logic don't shift as quickly. And when you return to this kind of states' rights discourse, you find all of these opportunities to enact other ways to contain black bodies and black lives, to really diminish so many of the gains that are made. And if we think about this in terms of eras of racial terror, slavery is a very particular era that's built on both the productive and reproductive labor of black people. When we move into Jim Crow, what can be exploited now is primarily is productive labor, and then we need to contain the reproductive possibilities for African Americans, which can come through violent racial terror, can come through overworking, obviously, still other forms of servitude. You get into carpetbagging, sharecropping, convict labor that come into fruition. So you find a new system of racial terror that takes its place, that is based on now controlling the population that was once controlled by chattel slavery.
With that in mind, Dr. Moody, and I like the term, Dr. Lindsay, this notion of being amended into justice. Could you talk just a bit about what was specifically happening with black women at this time? And I say that because as we begin to turn to thinking about the Black Lives Matter movement, we have this notion that black women are not involved, when in fact they're at the forefront of this. So we really want to situate them kind of in the middle of our discussion.
Okay. So, yes, I can do that. First of all, I need to tell you, I can't hear Dr. Lindsay.
Okay.
Okay.
We'll try to fix that on our end.
Okay. So I'm not sure what ground she has already covered. But when I think about women who are doing important work during Reconstruction, I think first and foremost about Frances E.W. Harper, who had been a leading abolitionist before the 13th Amendment was ratified, throughout the war, actually starting her career around 1850. And she was perhaps the most prominent civil rights activist, if you will, term that they would not have used at the time, an activist for black citizenship. She was in the pulpit. The things that are amazing about her include that she would speak for hours at a time. We have records of the speeches that she gave, and she would stand in the pulpit addressing hundreds of people. She was not an evangelical person, although there are Christian themes running throughout her work. But she spoke in churches for the most part, and in other kinds of lecture halls, and reached millions of people through the press and through her speeches. And she wrote in every possible genre. And she's probably the most prominent woman that we can think of in terms of leading women's rights movement. She spoke like Collins' essays. Collins died in 1865. Collins is the woman I was mentioning before, whose essays had a long-ranging impact because they were published in the Christian Recorder. So Collins was not the kind of preeminent figure that Harper was, but you know, we think of people like Harriet Tubman, whose voice was not often heard, but her impact is immeasurable, as we know from the thousands of people that she rescued across her lifetime on what is better known as the Upper Ground Railroad rather than the Underground Railroad. We think, of course, of Sojourner Truth. There is no talking about women working during Reconstruction without those figures. But it would be, you know, erroneous to say that we can sum up women's contribution with those three figures. Instead, you know, women were seizing the opportunities. They were led by these women. They were greatly influenced by the momentum that they created in their publications, in their speeches, in their, you know, from the pulpits and so forth, in the brises that they published, in the ways that they dictated how women could and should live, and I mean specifically black women in the wake of Reconstruction. But again, not just these three that I've mentioned who are so well known. But from the moment of, across the abolitionist period, well into the end of the century when we get to the Club Women's Movement, we have women everywhere. Ordinary women we might think of doing impossible, improbable, spectacular things, working with their churches, working with the Freedmen's Bureau, inaugurating schools. Harriet Jacobs, a woman who wrote an extraordinary slave narrative, founded a school in Virginia, for example, and on and on.
Excellent. So if you just joined us, I'm talking with Dr. Joyce Lynn Moody, and she's from UT San Antonio, and Dr. Treva Lindsay from The Ohio State University. After the break, we're going to get into this conversation around post-racial optimism and Black Lives Matter realism to pick up on something Dr. Lindsay just introduced. Going to break, we're going to listen to an interview with Fountain Hughes from Baltimore, Maryland, June 11th, 1949, a formerly enslaved woman with the Writers Project Agency, talking about the process.
Who did you work for, Uncle Fountain?
Who did I work for?
Yeah.
You mean when I was a slave?
Yeah, when you were a slave, who did you work for?
Well, I belonged to Burnley's when I was a slave. My mother belonged to Burnley's. But we was all slave children, and soon after, when we found out that we were free, well, then we were bound out to different people, Ficklin and Andrews and all such people as that, and we would run away and wouldn't stay with them. Well, then we'd just go and stay anywhere we could, lay out all night and anywhere. We had no home, you know. We just turned out like a lot of cattle. You know how to turn cattle out in the pasture? Well, after freedom, you know, colored people didn't have nothing. Colored people didn't have no beds when they were slaves. You all slept on the floor, pallet here and pallet there, just like a lot of wild people. We didn't know nothing. Didn't lie to look in no book. And there were some freeborn colored people where they had a little education, but there were very few of them where we was. And we all had a, what you call, I might call it now.
You get a fast car. I want a ticket to anywhere. Maybe we make a deal. Maybe together we can get somewhere. Any place is better. Starting from zero, got nothing to lose. Maybe we'll make something. Me, myself, I got nothing to prove.
This is Dr. K. Welcome back to the Mark Steiner Show. I just think there's nothing better than listening to Tracy Chapman singing about a fast car. If you just joined us, I'm talking with Dr. Joyce Lynn Moody and Dr. Treva Lindsay, and we've been talking about the 150th anniversary of the 13th Amendment. You can join our conversation here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the source of cool jazz in your community, at 410-319-8888, or email us at talk@steinershow.org. We want to hear from you. So we're now turning our attention to Black Lives Matter. For the past 150 years, there have been times when we as a black community have felt that we have moved ahead. I'm thinking of all the successes from the modern civil rights movement, the rise in the black middle class, the number of college graduates, black people in positions of power throughout the country, from the principals to the president. But are we making progress? Dr. Lindsay, are we making progress here?
That was a very, very challenging question. I think that this current moment makes it very difficult to think about what progress looks like, what we measure that by, and the fact that we're on this call, we're all professors, and are doing a certain kind of work, that I'm seeing such dynamic and amazing activism among a new generation of activists who are taking to the streets, who are taking to these institutions. I think that's very encouraging. But the fact that we need this kind of activism right now is suggestive of the fact that anti-Black racial terror has found its newest form in which to exact itself, and that perhaps what we're talking about is not simply reform, but to hearken to the song you just played, is really about revolution and transformation. I think there's been a considerable amount of conversation about what that looks like, what that means in this so-called post-racial moment, which really means a hyper-racial moment. There's this real desire to get beyond racism without dealing with the vestiges of slavery, the vestiges of Jim Crow, the current state of the prison industrial complex. There's a real push to move beyond that because we remain uncomfortable with not living up to our democratic ideals in theory. But as stated earlier, we recognize our democratic ideals are very much so an anti-Black set of ideals. And so part of what we're seeing is just the continuation of what our state is founded upon, what our nation is founded upon, and a more sophisticated way in which to enact that, so that it almost plays to this idea of it's only racism when it's named or seen or articulated by certain people, and that we don't have to identify it as such, and we don't have to be conscientious of the historical roots of these varied things. So I think there are individuals and more progressive ideas about race and how to address racism that do exist in 2015. I, however, think that white supremacy, too, has progressed and grown in particular ways and found new ways to impact the lives of Black people, of brown people, of poor people, of disabled people, of queer people, of trans people. I think that minoritized position remains something that is always in conflict with the desires and will of the nation.
But this is not new. I mean, Dr. Lindsay, I want to follow up with you. The things that you're talking about are the same things that we have been trying to fight for years. These are not new issues. They may have transformed themselves and they look like they're new issues. But this notion of anti-Black racist terror manifested itself through the KKK, manifested itself through burning crosses in your yard, taking people off the house. Give me your nephew. I'm going to take him out because he might have whistled at a white woman. Like, these are the same type of issues. So really, Dr. Moody, is there progress here?
No, I feel the same way as Dr. Lindsay in terms of it's very difficult to measure progress because it depends on the kinds of things that we want to measure. You know, I talk a lot in my classes, and I have taught over the years at predominantly white institutions, PWIs. And right now I'm teaching at an Hispanic serving institution. And so what that means is that I've had over the years very few African-American students, which means that when I'm talking about race in the classroom, I'm generally talking about whiteness as a race or a non-Black subject position. So, you know, when I think about measuring progress in Black people's lives, I think about what does that look like from a white perspective or a non-Black perspective. And so I want to turn the question around often in my classes with my graduate students especially, what does it mean to be white in this day? And I agree so much with Dr. Lindsay saying that, you know, there's the focus, I love her term, anti-Black racist terror, and thinking about, you know, not just the KKK as it emerged during the end of the Civil War, and, you know, wreaked so much havoc in the short duration of the Reconstruction, but also Dylann Roof and, you know, the backlash, you know, after the flag came down in South Carolina recently. So measuring progress has a lot to do with what we think about white identities, their multiplicities, of course, just as we think about the multiplicities of Black identities.
Dr. Lindsay, since Dr. Moody has introduced the flag, I just want to talk about that, because it seems as if that there's this rush now to take down the flag, to remove all the statues. In a sense, it's almost as if it's a feeling that we're trying to whitewash all over these difficult parts of our history as if they never happened. I mean, as a historian, where do you stand on this?
Yes. I mean, this, again, is another challenging question, because I'm somewhere where I don't see the flag as often. I don't see it flying over my statehouse, right? So there's that part of it that I think I understand what symbols tend to mean for people and what symbols mean beyond this kind of superficial understanding of what it may represent and all of these contentious conversations. But the removal of flags, the tearing down of statues in honor of former Confederates or people tied to very clear white supremacist organizations or institutions is a Band-Aid to multiple bullet wounds.
Right.
It does not actually deal with the fact that you can take down a Confederate flag, which I understand and support absolutely, but also what is behind that that we're trying to dismantle? What is the thought process behind that? What are the logics behind that? What does it mean that in 2015 we're having a conversation about a flag in light of nine people being struck down so violently in a church, and not talking about the conversation as that is the very real, living, breathing movement of white supremacy. It's in that. It's not in the flag specifically.
Right.
It's in what happens. And so it's a both and for me, how we talk about symbols. The statue one, I think, is a little more complicated because these institutions need to be reminded that they're founded and grounded in white supremacy.
Right.
And I know that it's challenging for students and faculty of color walking across these campuses, having these daily reminders of this, but they're also receiving these daily reminders and microaggressions in the classroom,
right,
the lack of faculty of color, the lack of support for students of color on these campuses. This is where you get concerned, student 1950. This is where you get the protests at Yale. These kinds of actions are pushing the conversation, hopefully beyond the symbolic, to the substantive, because the substance of white supremacy is what is so damaging. And it's that substance that has to be critiqued, engaged, and tackled, as well as the symbolic, if these are things that continue to just resonate with people in such profound and deplorable ways.
Well, we want to go to a caller. We have Donna on the line from Baltimore who wants to talk a little bit about her life as a Black woman. Good morning, Donna. How are you? Welcome to the call.
Pretty good. How are you doing? And
thank
always
you.
A good show. We need more shows to talk about the plight of Black women in this country.
Thank you.
One of my biggest concerns go deeper. Poverty in the Black community has not really changed. Black women are more in poverty, and their children are also more in poverty. And we don't seem to talk about poverty and Black women, or just poverty in women, period. But in Black community, poverty is tremendous because, you know, in our communities, our children are getting shot in the streets. They're not learning. They end up in jail the most. You know, drugs. We got a lot of sexual assault and abuse among women and children. So we have some tremendous issues that we need to start vocally coming out and talking about. When I talk to my friends who are in the baby, I have a lot of friends who are older than me.
Mm-hmm.
They were born during the baby, the first and the second. I call them the first and the second baby boom group, those who turned 65 5 years
right.
ago, who turned 70, and then you have the ones who are in their early 60s.
Right.
They are so disconnected, not all of them, but a lot of them are so disconnected from reality in reference to race and racism and everything. And I notice in different age, in that different group, there's one group that's, they just don't want to have a conversation. They want the material things of they have arrived and whatever. Then you have the ones in their early 60s, and this is Black males, too, in that group that, you know, I've had friends with. I mean, I struggle arguing with them about race, racism, and self-hatred. I find a lot of them try to avoid being
Well, you know, thank you so much, Donna. Well, I'm going to stop it there because I want to give our guests just an opportunity to respond to what you're saying. Dr. Lindsay, Dr. Moody, it sounded like in the midst of everything Donna was saying, that was an excellent question that she posed, was around this notion of having an intergenerational struggle. So mm-hmm. the Black Lives Matter movement is dominated by young people. And what just happened in Chicago with the mile, where you have this kind of clash between some of the older civil rights activists and younger right. activists from the Black Lives Matter movement, can this truly be an intergenerational movement? Or is that just a farce that the media say that it's not intergenerational? Dr. Lindsay?
Sure. I do think it. I think it's more intergenerational than what mass media would have us believe. I know everything that I've been to in relation to Black Lives Matter, I've seen what would be considered elders of our community to babies in our community. There are conversations. Some of this isn't just generational. I find this even in conversing with people in my generation who disagree with certain tactics and disagree with certain approaches. This is complicated by class and ability and sexuality and gender that we see these fractures and things. I think we always have this idealization of the civil rights movement or even prior decades of African-American freedom struggles, and where we think everybody was just together and that there was just a unified approach to addressing racial justice. And that's just simply untrue. It's also simply untrue that it was the majority of Black people participating in these things.
It's and always been a small number.
It's always, and I think people need to really be reminded of that because of the ways in which small groups of people comparatively in terms of total populace can make substantive changes and really push forward the conversation. And in those conversations, you're going to have various approaches, various tactics, various strategies. It should be contentious. We're talking about our lives here. We're talking about the survival, living, and thrival of Black people. And there's so many fronts on which this war should be waged. And I do think there should be more spaces where these conversations between generations are happening and are happening in a way that is both respectful and engaged. But we shouldn't be afraid of contentious dialogue around this, because there's so much that's happening that needs us, that needs as many of us as possible on board with the general idea of racial justice, which also speaks to the caller's wonderful point about how we address poverty, how we address right. systemic state-sanctioned violence, which is divestment in public education, which is in health disparities, which is in housing discrimination, which is in ignoring and not really addressing crime, intra-communal crime, but thinking about the hyper-policing and surveillance of our communities that's directly related to all of these other social factors. And so having different sets of mobilization and different approaches, I think, is a really important thing. And I think we're seeing that with intergenerational coalitions and conversations that are happening. I think we also have to see it along class lines. I think we also need to be self-reflexive about the tensions that do exist and see how we get at that and be very bold about it. I'm not afraid of airing this dirty laundry and saying we're not all on the same page. But I think a lot of us are reading the same books.
Now, Dr. Moody, that's a very interesting comment that Dr. Lindsay just said, that when we're airing the dirty laundry, it doesn't matter that we're not all on the same page. She said we're all reading the same books, which I think is very interesting. But there is some tension there. I mean, there's some very real tension when you have what just happened this weekend. When you have civil rights activists from one age and the other age actually physically fighting, there is some tension there that's beyond just airing some dirty laundry. What do you think are some things that we can do to combat this? How can we bring people together under kind of this larger banner of Black Lives Matter?
Mm-hmm. I think I love Donna's comments, and I appreciate these questions so much. I don't think we can exaggerate how important they are. And I just want to follow up on Dr. Lindsay's recommendations for dialogue. And I just want to say, you know, there are so many spaces where we can have more dialogue. And I think that it means being honest with oneself and being honest with each other. I don't know that I imagine that there are many intergenerational conversations that are harmonious more than conflicting, because I think about all the grandparents and great-grandparents who are raising their grandkids. So when there's, you know, someone shot down in the streets, a Black youth shot down in the streets, the numbers of people who are grieving, you know, just concentric circles spanning out, right? And not only that, but the ages of those people, that is not just one group of young people. It is not just the people who are actively involved in the Black Lives Matter movement. Those are generations of people having conversations about how wrong it is. So I think conversations about that, conversations about what it means that there is such a gender gap that there is such an economic gap, in particular the sexual assault question that Donna raised, so so important. And the thing about that is silence. I think, you know, the, that is what is so harmful for both economic survival, harmful to economic survival, and to women getting the treatment that they need for to survive sexual assault. I think both of those, we just need far more conversations than we get secrecy to overcome the gap. I mean, there's no more shrouding it in the, not the injustice in the streets, and the Black Lives Matter movement is getting us to some places where we can open up conversation. I think we just need to keep going there.
Now, we have Yema on the line with us. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. What an interesting, stimulating conversation you're
having
this morning. I'm weighing in to say that in many ways, we as Black people need to step forward and take responsibility for some of the ills in our community, whether that ill is the problem of inadequate public education for our children. The PTAs are empty. Where are we?
Yes.
Whether that is the fact that 70,000 Black people have murdered 70,000 Black people in the past 10 years. What are we saying about that? I certainly hear the Black Lives Movement, but what are we saying? Do Black lives matter to other Black people? Because I don't hear that.
Mm.
I hear mostly Black lives matter when Black, when white policemen or policemen, period, are killing us. But what about the larger issue of us killing us? It is an issue that we cannot ignore. And when we talk about Black mothers in poverty, the census data and some research data have come out that says that they some poverty is underreported.
Mm-hmm.
They are dual family households where they don't report all their incomes. We need to step forward, report our incomes, get our skills set. You cannot say, I'm poor, I got three children, but yet when you're asked if you've gone to a technical school or just taken a course to improve your economic status, and you answer no and say, well, that's because of racism, I haven't done that. You have to take responsibility for your economic place in life.
Thank you so much for calling in. Dr. Lindsay, she raised a lot of issues, and I want to kind of pull them together because I know we don't have much time. So do Black lives matter to Black people? I mean, I know the obvious answer, but I want you to speak about this.
Yes, and I think this is one of the clear mischaracterizations, I think, often that's out there that I think a lot of people have about Black Lives Matter, that the folks who are marching on behalf of Black Lives Matter and talking about state and state sanctioned violence aren't concerned with intracommunal violence. And I want to be clear here that, you know, why I avoid using a term like black on black crime is just that most crime happens interracially.
Yes.
It happens within the communities that we live in. So that's for any community. But to be specific, I am concerned about what happens in our communities because white supremacy doesn't. And so I think being cared for and caring for one another is an important part of this movement. And so many of the people who are in Black Lives Matter are also the people who have been on the ground, who are holding the vigils, who are doing community work, who are doing basic services type work that harkens back to the work of the Panthers, doing the books and breakfast, doing community organizing, getting people off the street, doing community education and teach-in programs to respond to the gaps in
public education. So it is happening. I mean, what you're saying, it is happening. I mean,
it is happening,
yes.
And I think the media doesn't turn its eye to when this happens. I heard all these questions. Y'all are protesting the video, you know, and the murder of Laquan McDonald, but not with the murder of Tyshawn Lee. And I was like, where were you? Because we were out there for Tyshawn, for that nine-year-old. That devastated people. You don't know about the interrupters. You don't know about the work of the Black Youth Project. You don't know about how invested the Dream Defenders are, Hands Up United or Millennials. Millennials United, or Organization for Black Struggle, are always focused in the community. The spectacle of Black death brings the mass media to these protests and the things that we see with that. So I think we should always do more work. And I echo the sister's concerns about we need to think about what happens when we know the state isn't invested in us and we investing in ourselves in ways that holds the state accountable for its significant role in these conditions, but also loving on one another, which means we have to think about the violence that happens within our communities, too.
And I think the concern is also one of the things I think with Black Lives Matter is the moving away from the push asking about where the leaders are. So who's going to care for our communities? When are we going to do something? When are you going to do something? Rather than taking that upon yourself and making that change. I was thinking about something that Brittany Cooper from the Crunk Feminist Collective said when somebody said that the Black Lives Matter movement was, you know, leaderless. And she said it's leaderful. That, you know, you can start wherever you are and you can be a leader. You don't have to wait for Dr. King, wonderful as he was, to show up before you do a breakfast program. You don't have to wait for someone to come and change the schools before you go in there to the PTA meeting. I think that we need to start moving this responsibility back on ourselves rather than waiting for the whoever that person is you're waiting to come in and save you, whatever they look like and whenever they're going to arrive. Dr. Moody, what do you think about this notion that people are questioning whether Black Lives Matter to Black people? Black people are questioning this, actually.
I'm sorry, say it again. What about, I didn't hear the last part.
Well, this notion of Black people who are actually beginning to question whether Black Lives Matter to Black people, since we have so many things happening in our community.
Oh, I see. No, I think that the Black Lives movement is only one force. So I think, you know, I love Dr. Lindsay's point about community activism. It is happening. I think Brittany Cooper is absolutely right. It's leaderful. And I don't know that there needs to be, you know, some kind of center of power. I think that what we can do, what I was saying before about, you know, the kinds of activism that we can do in our communities, talking to each other. I'm thinking especially about reading groups. I'm talking about, you know, rap sessions like the old days, people getting together to work through very specific ideas for growth and self-empowerment in their communities. Start right where you are. I think it is already happening. I think that is the legacy of African-American history. I think that we have always done that across the centuries of being in this country. And so it is not new. It is never ceased. It's ongoing. And I think we just need to do more of it. I love this concept of loving on each other. It's really, really important. It was what I was trying to get at before in talking about dialogue.
So before we end here, if I can just have one last comment from Dr. Lindsay and Dr. Moody, what is one thing that you think that people can do right now to bring about change in their community?
Powerful question. I think right now we think about being disconnected so often, and there's this kind of hyper-connectedness in social media, and then in certain ways you can feel disconnected. And I would encourage everyone to see what is going on, what are the actions that are happening in your community. And I'd say find your skill set, what you're really good at, and see how you can contribute that to the movement. Maybe you're a caretaker and you can take care of people's children while they go to an event, right, that's doing something. Let's say you're a writer, right? If you're an artist, paint. I think people think they have to act in a certain way to be considered part of the movement. And the movement, as we said, is not only leaderful, but has so many ways in which we need the impact being made and on so many fronts. So I think finding what is it that I'm really good at, because that's what we need. We need you. We need us. And I think that's the kind of love offering that I mean when I say loving on us and loving each other well through these extraordinarily terroristic moments, means finding what you are uniquely gifted at doing and bringing that to the table in terms of the movement.
Excellent. So we're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank Dr. Joycelyn Moody. She is a Sue N. Denham Distinguished Chair in American Literature and Director of the African American Literatures and Culture Institute at the University of Texas, San Antonio. Thank you for coming on. Dr. Treva Lindsay, we've enjoyed you as well. Assistant Professor in the Department of Women's, Gender, and Sexuality Studies at The Ohio State University. On our way to break, thank you. I want to remind you that The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invest in you. More information at www.meq.com. We have to take a break here, but when we come back, it's our newest edition of Soundbites, our series about our food, our environment, and our world. Stay with us. You can also visit us online at steinershow.org and take a listen to some of our podcasts. This is Dr. K for Mark Steiner. Go forward and find a way to change the world. It's got to start with someone. Why not with you?